Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Kaboom as that bass drops in, which means, you know, it's time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to DLC, your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be, and that is completely free thanks to our sponsors this week, Robinhood and HelloFresh. They're bringing the show to you. DLC, of course, the show all about games and their many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata. That's spelled with two N's and one T. And I'm joined, as always, by my friend, slash co-host, slash nemesis. The guy who is always a showcase for the immortals, Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian!
Hello. I thought maybe you would still do Final Four or something. So I was a little caught off guard. I was going to be like, I would have liked to have won it all, but you know.
Whatever. It's WrestleMania Day. WrestleMania for me, greater than sign, Final Four. That's just me.
Like WrestleMania is today as we're recording or tomorrow when this is out?
Today as we're recording. Okay. It's Sunday. Yeah, we record on Sunday. People are probably listening to it on Monday, but yeah, WrestleMania 35, Showcase the Immortals.
Dang, WrestleMania is finally older than I am.
That is also not true. And it's funny that it would not be older than you are, and then as years go by, it would get older than you. It's finally older than you.
I start lying about my age, and WrestleMania keeps getting older.
Yeah, well, that says a lot. Hey, we got a lot of video game stuff to talk about this week. We have so many games to discuss. There's big news. I mean, it has been just big news week after big news week, and this week is no exception. But the greatest news is that we have one of my favorite guests to do it with. You know, the DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian. But this week, I'm so excited because DLC stands for deciding between lots of content. Because in order to do that, you need to know what's good. And from What's Good Games, our friend Andrea Renee is back with us. Hey, Andrea, how are you doing?
Ayo, what's good, guys?
Oh, you are just...
I remember you doing that intro with such gusto before. It's like you have an extra spike of energy today.
Maybe. I'm trying to salvage any energy I can have from my children. It's been an intense weekend. But I appreciate you saying that. Hey, you're just back from a whirlwind tour of the country. You went to the GDC. You went to the PAX East. You've been playing games. You've been doing panels. And we're so glad you were able to carve out time for us. But man, what a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, it's been hectic. I'm glad to have a tiny little lull here before I head back to LA for Games Beat Summit. Then, of course, you know, we're ramping up towards E3, which is just 2 months away, which is wild to think about.
Griff and I canceled our press conference this year. I don't know if you heard, but we're not doing a big one this year.
We're going to be doing a series of Nintendo Direct style events throughout the year, though. So
just podcasts like weekly, we were thinking with news, trying something new.
Oh, yeah. You know, I hear that weekly podcast thing is on the up and up.
We're trying. Hopefully it'll catch on one of these days. People will be into it. Oh, man. You say E3 and a shiver runs down my spine because it is going to be here so quickly and I don't even have the bumper queued up. I couldn't even do the E3 bumper, let alone be ready to go to meetings and see stuff. Ugh. Because we're on that topic, I know we have lots to talk about, but I'm just curious, what do you think about E3 this year? Do you think it's going to feel a little less than with no Sony?
I don't. I think that there is plenty of gaming content to go around. I'm really holding out hope that Google's going to swoop in with a really impressive Stadia lineup and some partners and something to show, because that technology, obviously announced at GDC just a couple weeks ago, was really fascinating, but left us all with a bunch of questions, and there's clearly a big gaping hole where PlayStation was. Now, I still think that PlayStation's going to do some announcements around GDC, or excuse me, around E3.
Some states of play.
Yeah, the second episode of State of Play, but I just don't think they'll be obviously like on the show floor anywhere. But I think E3 is still going to be great. We have a new console coming from Xbox, right? Xbox Maverick.
Yeah, they're talking about how they're going to come big this year. They're saying it's going to be one of their biggest years. So, yeah.
Yeah, dude, I'm ready.
I'm ready too. Well, I'm not ready. I am very much not ready, but I'm excited.
Well, you have some time to get ready. Don't worry.
Feels like very little. I'm just trying to get my taxes done at this point. I'm last minute Larry. Yeah.
I'm doing taxes right now, and I was like, I'm literally crying as I'm like writing the check out to the IRS.
All right. Let's not talk about taxes. Let's get into the show and start the way we always do with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happened in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com or by visiting our subreddit. That's 5x5dlc.reddit.com. Cool folks hanging out in that subreddit. I encourage you to give it a shot. Submit stories, talk about what we're talking about or anything gaming related there. Andrea, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Oh, man. Last week was such a big one. It's kind of hard to pick. So I'm going to pick the one that I'm most excited about, even though it's very much hearsay and speculation. And it's, did The Division 2 reveal the next Assassin's Creed?
Yeah, I am excited about this, too. Somehow, when I wasn't looking, Assassin's Creed became my favorite game franchise, like, all of a sudden.
I'm so happy to hear that. I love Assassin's Creed.
I didn't used to love Assassin's Creed, but post-Odyssey, I'm like, I want to hear every bit of news. I'm ready. What's the next one coming? I'm so excited. I loved Odyssey so much. And yeah, there's some sleuthing that was done inside Division 2. People found hints, an image that was sort of plastered on one of the walls in the Division 2 showed someone holding one of the apples of Eden from the Assassin's Creed franchise. And it said some sort of Norse mythology reference, some sort of Viking reference. And now Kotaku is reporting that they have sort of independent, anonymous confirmation from two sources saying it's going to be Viking Town. It's codenamed Kingdom, evidently, and we're going to get it in 2020. Ubisoft, that is, has already mentioned that there will be no new Assassin's Creed in 2019, so that's not too much of a surprise. But 2020 will come, and it will be set in the land of the Vikings. What do you think about this, Andrea?
I think this is such a perfect fit for the Assassin's Creed franchise for a variety of reasons. First off, they've made a very big emphasis on aquatic gameplay and naval mechanics and ship sailing over the last few Assassin's Creeds. And the Vikings are obviously known for their ships. So that is clue number one, that this is a good fit. The second thing is, I really love the way that the engine used in Assassin's Creed handles hack and slash gameplay with blade weapons. Didn't really particularly enjoy the ranged weapons, more of the gun type weapons that we got in a few of the Assassin's Creeds, like Syndicate, and for example. And so I think Viking era weapons would be fantastic in the combat that is Assassin's Creed. And then lastly, I really love the way that they've woven a lot of mythology into the last two Assassin's Creeds, both Odyssey and Origins, and brought in more of this mystical sense. Obviously, the Assassin's Creed franchise has had that reference to gods and mythology throughout the duration of the entire franchise, but they really put an emphasis on it in these last two games. And I think with the incredible amount of interest in Norse mythology, not only from the Thor movies from the Marvel universe, but now, of course, getting a renewed interest from God of War, which came out last year, I think this is a perfect time to bring back the appreciation for Norse mythology.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up God of War, because last time you were on this show, we were gushing about God of War, and it was an awesome episode where we went in detail about that game. We all loved it. It was our game of the year here on DLC. Do you
think? As it was mine.
Yeah, and deservedly so. And it's winning numerous of them all over the place. I mean, I feel like watching Corey's Instagram or Twitter feed is just like he's on tour of accepting awards right now. It's just like month after month of accepting awards, and deservedly so. But do you think that it may feel a little Me Too? Do you think it'll be in the shadow of that game? Is there a concern of it not feeling as... I mean, because there's no other game set in ancient Greece like Odyssey was, or in, you know, in ancient Egypt like Origin was. I feel like
where are the early God of War set?
That's funny. Okay, touche. But I don't feel like those were as sort of butted up against this game. But I take your point, Christian. I take your point.
I'm glad Christian said that, because there are obviously several games set in Egypt and in Greece. But to Jeff's point, they didn't have the robust gameplay offering that we found in the Assassin's Creed franchise. Or they didn't execute it as well, I would say.
Yeah, those games felt like I was exploring a part of history, a time period, a milieu, a look and feel that I had never really gotten to explore before. And I don't know if it'll feel quite the same. The reason I'm bringing this up is, from my perspective, I'm really hoping they lean into sort of a different style of Viking. I hope it's more Viking than it is sort of North mythology. Like you said, Andrea, I love that the mythology stuff sort of peeks in the Assassin's Creed franchise, but it very much is like second or third layer down. You know, it's like you have to really search it out, and it's special when you find it. And it's not a world of mythical creatures. It's a world where there are hidden mythical creatures, but mostly what you're doing is not mythical stuff. And I feel like that version of Viking history, where it really feels like you're exploring not the myths, not the Nordic myths, but like the real history of what the Vikings did, I think that would be cool.
Absolutely. It's interesting because I recently took a trip to Copenhagen in Denmark with my family, and we went to a museum there, and they had an exhibit on Vikings and like the life of the, like, kind of day in the life of during that time period in that era, from, you know, artifacts that were found, from utensils people used and how people dress, and et cetera, et cetera. And I think that there's a lot to explore there, to your point. And I think Ubisoft has such a commitment to historical accuracy, and really the educational mode that they put into Odyssey, I thought was fantastic. And I look forward to them doing that more and adding more modes like that in their future franchises, because their IP team does such incredible, extensive work making sure that they're being true to some of these really important historical points, that it's an exciting prospect. So yeah, I'm pumped. I'm all aboard for Assassin's Creed Vikings, or Valhalla, or whatever they call it.
Valhalla, that's a good title, actually. Just the accents alone, based on how they did the accents in Origins and Odyssey, like they got actors who really nailed that. Just the accents for a Viking game alone will be a delight. I mean, just a pure delight. Christian, what is your take on Viking Assassin's Creed?
Yeah, I like it. I think it fits for what the franchise is doing. And it's easy to picture God of War as the Viking game, but there's also other takes on it. Like, two examples I'll give of, I think, playing in that world in vastly different ways would be Hellblade, which also does like Norse mythology and does not feel like God of War, in my opinion, but still has some really cool combat, but uses other parts of that. And then I believe the Banner Saga, both one, two, or three of those games. I know the first game is also inspired by like Norse mythology and kind of the artwork in that game, and also very different than Hellblade or God of War. So I think there's room for the Assassin's Creedification of Norse mythology, and climbing through ice sounds really cool. You know, like exploring a cold frost environment. I picture like fur pelts that you're upgrading and,
And
kind of building new outfits looks really awesome. I think is really neat. I think, as Andrea said, their hand-to-hand combat, I think, has only gotten better between Origins and Odyssey, and I'm sure they'll continue to iterate that. Like, dual axes just sounds incredible to me. And then I'm hoping that there's some mix of, like, breaking through ice and sailing, kind of something like the idea of you're on a treacherous footing as you're kind of crossing a frozen lake or something like that, I think could be really compelling too, and kind of how they establish the world and your traversal over it. I think there's a lot to like there.
Yeah, I'm on that page too. I'm very excited about this. And there, as many hours as I spent on beautiful Grecian beaches and, you know, watching sunsets against, you know, dappling sunlight on water through the palm trees, like to go from that to now, as you're describing these, you know, frozen tundras and ice peaks and ice lakes and rivers. I just think that will be such a cool place to take this, this franchise. I'm excited about it. I mean, I would be excited. I think there were people saying it might be Rome. I know I predicted that it was going to be feudal Japan, but this seems like a really, really cool place to take it. So hopefully this is true. It sounds like it's a pretty solid rumor. So we'll see.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Christian Spicer, what is your story of the week?
My story of the week has to be that you're buying Labo VR. Like,
I guess I am.
You can't not buy it now. Full. So Mario, little vignettes or little small Mario Odyssey levels are going to be available, playable in Labo VR. And all of Zelda Breath of the Wild. For you, sir, to say that VR would get you back into No Man's Sky if only they added it. And here, Breath of the Wild, a game that, you know, you never quite connected with. We both kind of praised what it was doing, but it didn't quite grab you in the same way it did a lot of other people. Now you can play the whole game in VR. You have no excuses. Yes, it's a cardboard VR strapped to your head, but you have to be in.
My excuse is that I'll be playing No Man's Sky VR this whole time, and how will I possibly play both?
This is huge. It's so bizarre to me.
It's pretty crazy. It's pretty good. So backing up a little bit, if you are a frequent listener of the show, you may remember that I poo-pooed the idea of a Labo VR because I was worried it sounded like a really kind of crappy version of VR. I got a lot of emails and tweets during the New York preview week when people – I don't know. Andrea, did you or anybody on your team get a chance to try out the Labo VR because they were giving – demos to people, I think, in New York?
No, did not get a chance to try it, but I have read several previews that all said, yo, this isn't supposed to look this good. What's going on?
Yeah, everybody sent me emails and tweets about how, like, oh, guess you're wrong, Jeff. Everybody's saying it's great, much better than it should be for what it is. And nothing could make me happier.
I mean, okay, I don't want to rain on the hype parade. I talked about this at length when I was first reported this news on Kinda Funny Games Daily last week. And I think the idea of short mini Labo experiences are really cool. The idea you get to build it and kind of customize it, neat. I think when they announce something like a full VR support for a game as intense and open and big as The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, I take pause because I played that game for several hours at a time, and you have to hold the cardboard. This isn't like a soft padded VR headset. We're talking Google Cardboard style VR Labo to your face. So you're literally holding it up to your face the entire time. And I just
Where are your hands? You know, like how I don't even know how that works. It boggles my mind.
Switch with the Joy-Cons attached. So, you know, traditional style. But instead of holding it out in front of your face, like at a good distance where you're maybe putting your elbows on a table or it's at a nice angle, you have to hold it up to your face. So you're holding the Labo with the little lenses on the inside, like physically holding it to your face.
I completely agree with you, Andrea. I feel like somebody at Nintendo got my letters but completely misinterpreted them. You know, like, yes, if you're going to do this, do it right. Why are you wasting our time with Labo? Like, put out the thing. It's cost $80 anyway. Put out a real thing. Like, put out a plastic comfortable thing with straps that I can put on my head. Let's do it. If we're going to do it, let's do it. Don't like do it this way. I don't understand. I'm so excited that they're so there are going to be built-in mini games with Labo VR that a lot of people who have played them say they're pretty fun and interesting and effective and create a really cool VR experience. And that's great. And then they also said that Mario Odyssey on Switch will support some brief mini games as well, specifically set in Seaside and the Luncheon Kingdom areas. Nintendo describes these levels as bite-sized. So that makes sense to me. And then they're like, oh, and also all of Breath of the Wild. It's like, okay, so they clearly put some work into this. Why not support that work with actual hardware that you would want to play through all of Breath of the Wild with?
You are saying exactly how I feel with the enthusiasm that I have as well, because I loved Breath of the Wild. I love the Mario franchise. The idea of being able to play a Super Mario Brothers game in VR, and it's so perfectly suited to VR, Super Mario Odyssey, is like, this is so great. But then when they're like, but it's cardboard and you have to hold it. And then they have the photos, the press photos of these kids using one hand to hold the VR to their face and one hand they're holding a Joy-Con. I'm like, that's the most impractical thing I've ever heard of in my life. VR is already difficult to do, even if you have the most comfortable headset and you have it perfectly adjusted. The idea that you have to physically hold it to your face and then use another hand to do the inputs, and you're going to do this for more than 10 minutes at a clip. It's like, oh, Nintendo, you're so close to getting it right.
I wonder, I mean, for my Breath of the Wild experience, I hit what felt like frame rate dips in handheld mode. And so what is this thing? Like, again, the Labo experiences in VR I've heard are great. I could see how those would run smoothly. I'm not sure how Breath of the Wild in handheld mode runs in. Don't you need 90 frames per second to make
the minimum? The minimum anybody does comfortably, supposedly, in VR is 60 frames per second. Oculus shoots for 90 for maximum comfort. This is going to be locked at 30. So you're at half what anybody else's minimum in VR is. Plus, the VR resolution is going to be 720 by 640 per eye. So pretty low resolution at a very low frame rate for that amount of time in that kind of world. I shudder at anybody for whom this is their first VR experience. And again, I haven't tried it. Maybe there's some Nintendo magic I'm not aware of. Clearly some people who have played these short experiences already are coming away speaking very positively of it. And I'm happy to hear that, but I just have so many reservations and worries about this, because I want it to be the thing that sells people on more robust, interesting VR. I want it to be the thing that sells Nintendo on jumping into this, because having played something like Astro Bot Rescue Mission, I go, Nintendo should be making VR games. So I'm rooting for it, and I don't want it to be half-assed and lame, you know?
Are you going to buy it?
I mean, I guess I have to, right?
I want to play it, and I'm hoping you're the one that buys it.
I have to
come over and check it out with you. Yeah,
I can't not, right? I got to.
I'm not going to pretend that I'm not curious, right? I definitely want to know, like, what's going to happen, and what I really want to see what these Mario experiences are going to be like, because I think that's really where they could have something. Obviously, playing Zelda in VR would be fun, but I think you, Jeff, as probably the resident VR expert of the three of us, can attest that the best VR experiences are those that are specifically designed for VR and not just like an add-on mode for another game.
Yeah, that's true. Although, I mean, there's plenty of add-on modes that have been pretty good too. You know, like the Star Wars Battlefront little VR add-on mode is pretty great. You know,
when I say add-on, I don't mean as like an additional experience. I mean a game that they just made in VR. Like, let's take a Skyrim in VR, for example.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I think playing Skyrim on a regular console or PC is a superior experience than playing it in VR.
Yeah, I would agree in the sense that they had to retrofit, and this is your point, they had to retrofit everything to work inside the control scheme of VR, and it's not ideal. Like, if they had built
Astro Bot Rescue Mission, right?
Right. It's not, if they had built Skyrim from the ground up to work in VR, I think it would be a completely different kind of thing.
Correct.
So you're right, But also, you know, Resident Evil 7 is pretty great, and Borderlands 2 is pretty great. Or, you know, there's ways to do it, but I'm very curious. And I think, Christian, I will have to say that I'm probably going to buy this just to satisfy my curiosity. So it goes at $80, I guess, and and an afternoon of cardboard crafting.
I'll help you with the crafting if you fork over the money.
Fair enough. All right. My story of the week is, I think we have to talk about this expose, really, in Kotaku. Jason Schreier, who I've had many, many conversations with about being on the show, and his schedule is very difficult, and our schedule is very difficult. It's been an ongoing thing. Would love to have him on. But man, he is just knocking it out of the park right now over on Kotaku. Just great reporting week after week. He did something again this week, published an article, actually two big articles. He published one in the New York Times, I think.
Yeah, anyway, one was in the Times.
Yeah, the one I want to talk about specifically is the Kotaku article about Anthem, and really more about BioWare in general and the culture of BioWare. It is a very long, deep, well-researched expose into how Anthem came to be, the 4 to 5 year development process that resulted in the game we got, and how that sort of is indicative of a culture at BioWare that can kind of explain the Mass Effect Andromedas of the world and the Anthems, and how these sort of tumultuous road to release of these games and a burnout culture inside the studio itself has led to a lot of people, leaving and having negative experiences there. It's a very deep, detailed article. I highly recommend, if you're listening to this, to check it out.
It's like a free chapter of Blood, Sweat, and Pixels 2. Like, his book is excellent. Yeah. And this is could have straight up been a chapter in that book. It's phenomenal.
We're not going to be able to do the article justice in summarizing it, because it's full of really interesting details. But for my money, the reason I'm bringing it up as a story of the week, first of all, I'm very excited to get Andrea's take on this. Andrea really was a ground zero for a lot of Anthem. You know, Andrea hosted the EA Play at E3, a lot of which
best
was
Best Host,
about,
Last Host.
Best Host, Last Host. Yeah, they couldn't top you, so they had to stop.
You know? I know, right?
you interviewed the devs there and were part of the big reveal of that game. And so I'm sure you have opinion, and you're a big BioWare fan for many years. So I'm curious to get your take. But there are three big takeaways that I'll just sort of cue this up, the discussion up for. For me, the first is, and credit where credit is due, Christian, because you have brought this up a number of times and I've been skeptical, but it sounds like Frostbite is a big, big problem for all of EA. It's a very problematic engine across the board, which is interesting. Secondly, this idea of, how developers work, how human beings are kind of treated crappily at a lot of developers. And, I've been an advocate for unionization, but it sounds like, you know, this is a very deep problem that Casey Hudson has come out and said is real and wants to address. That's another big point. And then the third point for me is, I think the biggest that I'd like to talk about, and that is so much of what we saw and I think see a lot in video games, and people are very cynical and skeptical, and I am one that has often given companies the benefit of the doubt, but so much of what we see is smoke and mirrors. And that really seems like the case with Anthem. When we saw this big trailer at the first E3 that it was shown, the teaser that where it closed Microsoft's press conference, that was thrown together at the last minute. The team itself didn't know that the game was going to be like that until they saw that trailer. And then they set out to make a game that would be that trailer instead of having that trailer be a snippet of a game that they were already making. So I know that's a lot, and those are wide-ranging topics, but it is a big article. Andrea, what is your reaction, your top-level reaction to all of this?
My high-level reaction is that it's clear from Anthem's launch that there were lots of problems along the path to development of this game. As somebody who was very excited, in fact, Anthem was my most anticipated game of this year, I was let down, and I'm not going to, mince words about that. I think that there is an incredible potential for Anthem to make a fantastic comeback. We've seen several games do it over the last couple of years that had a very rough or rocky start, or maybe they were a good game at launch but failed to find an audience but then found one later. So I think that there's hope for Anthem to turn it around as long as the devs remain committed.
Diablo, Destiny, Destiny 2, Warframe, which is kind of now pointed as
Elder Scrolls Online. There are a number of very big examples, yes.
So I think that there's definitely potential, because I think what they're doing with that game, particularly with the flight mechanics and your javelins, is such a unique experience, and BioWare has the potential to make something good. So I want to say that. Obviously, Jeff gave my disclosures already that I worked with EA on Anthem-related things, specifically at EA Play last year. But I mean, the article is troubling, you know, and the thing that struck me about it was, and I was really not that surprised, because this is a story we hear time and time again throughout the world of video game development. BioWare is not the only one to suffer from these problems. Like, these types of problems are super prevalent. I think last year, Rockstar's, you know, moment in the spotlight in this negative way about what was happening at that studio kind of got pushed under the rug because everybody was fawning over how great Red Dead 2 was. And now, because Anthem launched with issues, people are highlighting the problems within BioWare a little bit more than maybe another studio would. But these are commonplace problems in creative workspaces, not just in video games, but really at large. And I'm not saying that makes it okay. In fact, it makes it not okay. I feel like it's a systemic problem that we need to figure out how to fix.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And well said. Christian, what is your take on this?
I mean, yeah, I want to reinforce what you said is read the article, I think, and it is lengthy, but, you know, get it on a computer or an iPad. Don't start it on your phone unless that's the only way you have to read it. I think the thing that I am most concerned with was BioWare's initial response, and they kind of levied a response before they even really had time to read the article. And the response I felt, and I know they've come out after, well, I guess an internal memo was maybe leaked, and it seems like they're taking it a little more seriously. But I felt as if their initial response seemed to deflect and not want to focus on the issue. And I understand from a PR perspective, you kind of need to do that. You're part of a big publicly traded company. But also, I think there's a better way that it could have been handled than the kind of the way BioWare went about it. And I think the bigger issue is you got to really look at yourself in the mirror and take time to listen to your employees and the people that you value. You know, there's all these anecdotes that large companies have in creative houses and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, we're no good than our least valuable member, everyone, you know, like we wouldn't exist if it wasn't for you, and we all build each other up and blah 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 blah, right? We're the sum of our parts. And I think you need to actually live by that and not just have it as like a catchphrase that you high five each other with or something, and really take time to listen to people's concerns and don't let passion be an excuse for a crappy workplace or a bad work environment or a toxic work environment, because a lot of times passion will, you know, serve as the blanket to cover things, because people want to make great games. They really do. You know, they want to make cool stuff. They want to make the next BioWare hit. They're going to put up with stuff to be a part of this business in this industry that they love, but that can't be an excuse to keep doing bad things because people are willing to suffer through it.
Yeah. You know, part of my takeaway, and maybe this is a little silver lining, but part of my takeaway from this article is it's kind of incredible that Anthem is as good as it is based on how that game came to be. It sounds like the game we played was really made in less than a year, that this game was in, you know, had a 5 to 6 year development cycle where almost nothing was done. There were all these big conversations and lots of stops and starts and lots of aborted ideas and, you know, ideation and conceptualization and all stuff was happening, but no game. And then all of a sudden there was a fake trailer, not fake, but a idealized trailer that was revealed, and that, okay, now we're making this. And then they made that in like 12 to 18 months. Like, you know, really the bulk of it was made in like 10 months. And that is insane. Like that the game is even as good as it is, as fun as it is, that the flying field, I mean, they stuck the flying in at the last minute. And it is remarkable and shows the talent of the people at that studio. So there is, I think, kind of a, I guess, a positive way to take that. And it's a shame that the game had to be rushed like that and crunched, and people had to give up so much of their lives and be worked to the bone, and their stress levels peaking to the point where they had to, you know, break down and take time off and all that stuff because they were so stressed out. All of that is really unfortunate and wrong, in my opinion. Shouldn't happen. But it's amazing that the game is actually kind of fun. And I think you're right, Andrea, that there's a chance for that thing to evolve into something cool. I'd like to ask you guys, as people who cover this stuff and have done for a long time, do we all need to be more cynical? I hate cynicism and I fight against it all the time. But in looking at this in the face, looking at the facts of what's happening, when I was bouncing off the walls after that E3, what, 2 or 3 years ago, when they showed Anthem and they were flying and it was all seamless and we were going in the water and coming out of the water and flying, and they closed Microsoft's show, and I was just like bouncing off the walls in excitement about this game. And it wasn't a game. It wasn't a game. They couldn't make that with the tools that they had. They had to make a different thing that was close, but it wasn't the game they even wanted to make. How do we handle the fact that that is how games are announced and marketed, where no one is being upfront with the fact that they haven't built it yet? Andrea, what do you think?
I mean, I feel like I'm trying to, the whole time you were setting up the question, I was trying to get a grasp on like what the question was and how got involved with it. I think, you know, taking trailers that are displayed as announcement trailers with a grain of salt is always, you know, a good call, but it's tough because I constantly find myself in this battle between wanting to give in to the hype and then always wanting to be realistic. And for me as an online personality and who commentates on several shows, it's like damned if I do, damned if I don't. Like if I get excited and I'm down the hype train, then I'm not doing my due diligence. But then if I'm too cynical and I'm too critical, then I'm just raining on everybody's parade. And I feel like there's no happy medium between like, I'm super excited for this. OMG, it looks amazing. I don't care if it's all CGI. It looks cool. Versus yeah. Like, I don't know, they're never going to be able to make this work and blah, blah, blah. It's a tough spot to be in. I think that, you know, video game development is difficult and projects change. The creative scope of projects change over time. And I think the audience just needs to manage their expectations better. I think this is something that the video game industry uniquely struggles with in the entertainment media landscape at large. Because like we don't get to see rough cuts of the Avengers movie and like take a look at it in pre-alpha when they like are still working on the graphics effects and haven't like fully put all the green screen and blue screen effects in yet, right? Like,
but they're also not marketing Avengers Endgame by showing you sections of the script that haven't been filmed yet. And going, exactly. This is the movie we're going to make. And they're like, and then, you know, later on they found out, oh, we had to rewrite that and we had to pull that part out and we couldn't make
precisely.
That part. Of the- so
yeah, no, yeah. And that's what's different, I think, about video games. And obviously, clearly not apples to apples, right? Movies and video games are not the same type of media. They're very different for a wide variety of reasons. So don't get your panties in a bunch if you're listening to this. Like, I understand that these comparisons are not the same, but like my point is that it's a problem unique to video games, because for as long as I've been covering video games, which has been over 10 years now, part of the ongoing coverage pre-release has been dependent on press people getting hands-on experiences and seeing large chunks of the game to get their opinion on it. And I think that's what's really troublesome is like if the creative team decides, hey, that thing we showed the press, we actually decided isn't going to be the best for the final vision of the game. And maybe we need to rewrite it or change the graphics. But then they get crucified for making that change and saying, well, you misled us. You misrepresented what it was. It's like a really tough spot for developers to be in.
Yeah. It's a tough spot for developers. It's a tough spot for the audience. It's a tough spot for those of us that try to cover video games. It's an unfortunate place to be. I think the easiest solution, or not solution, but you know, thing that can help, is don't pre-order games. Just don't pre-order games. That maybe can take a little bit of the stress and pressure off of it. Like, if you just don't buy a game based on it not being out yet, that's a helpful. But Christian, do you have any solutions here? Do you have any concerns? What's your take?
Yeah, I feel like it's we need to shift how we talk about things. And for me personally, what I try to do with things like this is get excited about the thing, whatever it is. We'll use Anthem as an example. But explain what you're excited about and say that you're excited about that trailer. Or if you go hands on with a demo build of the game, I think people talking about the game could say that what they liked about the, I'm just going to make up a thing, you know, Ink Pen 2 demo was this, that, and the other, and let people know that you're not playing the game. What you liked about the demo you were playing was this, that, and the other, and how it did this, that, and the other. And you hope that they expand on this or dial this back and be honest and kind of transparent about the things you enjoyed, what you want to see more of, knowing that it isn't the full game, you didn't get to play the full game, and kind of talking about what that experience was. Because I think even with, you know, CG fully rendered trailers, I think you can still get excited about, I'll use Batman Arkham Origins, where that trailer between Batman and who was it? Deathstroke. It was just a pre-rendered fight scene, but it was incredible, right? And it was in the snow, and they were like, I think in a shipping container, train yard, something like that. And it's kind of saying, okay, if this is the tone of what they're doing, this is what I like about this. I like this take on Deathstroke. And I think you can get excited about what you are being given and then extrapolate that to what you hope that means the final product will be. And then we're fortunate. I think instead of being at a disadvantage, I think we are, it's an advantage situation where we're able to then revisit that when the final thing comes out and say, like, oh, you know, I was blown away by this and they really captured the tone of this and they did this right. Or, oh man, what I was really excited about Anthem was this big seamless world. And while the flying and the combat is some of the best third person flying combat I've ever experienced, to me, it failed to live up to the expectations I had of a big open seamless world with my friends. So if you're looking for good, you know, air to ground combat, this is going to be the game for you. If you're looking for a big open sandbox to play, you know, maybe wait for the Division 2. And I think it's how we frame the conversations and things that we're doing and experiencing, we can really help our audiences instead of just hyping them for the finished product. Hype them up for the thing that we, if you honestly are hyped by it, for the thing we saw and experienced, and then revisit that later.
I think that's exactly right. And that's exactly what I try to do. I can give you a concrete example, actually, from the Wayback Machine. I remember going to an event when BioShock Infinite was coming out, and I was able to play the first hour or two, I think, of BioShock Infinite. And I remember famously saying, I think on Weekend Confirmed.
I think it was Weekend Confirmed, yeah.
Yeah, I remember saying the first hour of BioShock Infinite is my game of the year. And then the game came out, and a lot of people were disappointed by it on the whole. And I even had some things to say that were less than stellar. And some people are like, oh man, you must be eating your words now. You're eating crow. You feel stupid for saying that. And I remember thinking, and still believe now, no, I stand by what I said. Like, that, if the game had continued apace like what I saw, I thought the opening sequence to BioShock Infinite is one of the finest sequences of gameplay I've ever experienced. It is incredible the way they bring you into that world, the way they introduce concepts and mysteries, and some of the stuff that I got to play was amazing. And it didn't sustain. It kind of it fell apart a little bit as it went on, and it couldn't sustain over. I think the game is still very good. I don't think it was bad, but it wasn't the level of that intro sequence. And I think that's exactly to the point of what you're saying, Christian, is that I try to be completely honest about what my reaction to what I am seeing or playing at that time. And And I think that it's perfectly viable to reassess, as you said, and make new claims, make new, express new feelings about the thing that when you play it on the whole, or when you find out more and you get more. It's like saying, you know, the first two episodes of a television series are incredible, but oh my gosh, the last six didn't really live up. I think that's perfectly legitimate. And it is, it's not about trying to hype an audience up so they'll get revved up to buy something and then pull the wool out from under them. It is being honest about your moment to moment reaction with what you've experienced thus far.
Here's maybe a reframing of this question, and Andrea, I'd love to get your take on it. As you know, to some extent, we are part of consumerism, right? We're talking about products that no one needs in their life. We all love them, but we're hyping into that machine, right, of buying things. And so, let's say we're covering things kind of the way we talked about, and then so Anthem comes out, and it's whatever you think Anthem is, you know, anywhere from a 1 to a 10, doesn't matter what you think of it, but it's out now. The Division 2 is next month. And it's, so it's still only been in that hype, you know, preview train area. Like how can we best convey that stuff to listeners and consumers, or how can people, you know, make that decision? Cause I think that's where it gets interesting, where so many of these games now are often very enjoyable experiences, being in on the ground floor and kind of being part of that zeitgeist of leveling up and experiencing these worlds. And so when one thing is out and fully realized and the other thing is still only in that hands-on impression, I'm not saying pre-order the Division, but I mean, it can affect a current purchase based on a future promise. Does that make sense at all?
Yes, it certainly does. And obviously buying video games is an expensive hobby and you should be discerning with your money. And I have said time and time again that if your money is very strictly budgeted, you shouldn't be really buying any games at launch. You should be waiting until you hear initial impressions, until day one patches are released, because the games just
price
don't
drops.
Yeah, listen, the games just don't release fully baked anymore. Like it's very, very rare that a game is going to be shipped on a disc that doesn't have a day one patch. That's just not the world of game development that we live in. And the sooner that you accept that realization and move on, the happier you'll be. Like there's so many people that are just fighting it, being like, how could they ship a game that's broken? I go, it wasn't broken. They shipped a day one patch. That's why I got so bent out of shape about the Anthem reviews in that early PC release period, because BioWare shipped a patch and the game as it was just doesn't exist anymore. And so I got upset that there were these multitude of reviews reviewing a game in its not finished state that consumers can't play. And it's
Well, they could
for about 6 days. You were correct. For about 6 days, that game was a hot garbage fire. and listen, like it still has a lot of issues, and we don't need to go into that at this moment for sure. But it's a tough place to be in, and the thing I always come back to, and the thing I want people to just hold on to and remember, is that this is a leisure activity. Video games is a passion, is a hobby, is something you do on the side, or maybe you do it full time because you're a streamer. But let's not forget, like, video games are just that. They're a game. They're a form of entertainment. And how people are getting so upset and so angry on the internet over video game purchases. I'm like, if this is really making your life terrible, you should stop buying video games then, maybe. I don't know what else to tell you.
Like, I know, it is.
It's like either you throw your hands up and go, yo, sometimes shit's broken or bad, and that's just the way it is, or you just stop making the purchase. I don't know, Jeff, what do I do?
No, you're right. It is often a disproportionate response, and it's hard to look in the face of that and understand it. And I get it. I mean, these are, if you are passionate about a thing, that passion runs deep and expresses itself sometimes in, I guess, ugly ways. It's unfortunate. And I think it's worthwhile to take a breath and understand that, you know, these things aren't end of the world. But it is also, you know, a bummer that we've gotten to this place where these products are evolving and it's hard to take a snapshot and understand. I mean, it's hard reading this article, getting back to the sort of the topic at hand, reading this article, it's the tragic takeaway is that there was a line in the sand where they said this game has to come out. You know, like it feels like it's great that they're going to continue to work on it and patch it and things will change, but it shouldn't be out yet. You know, this should be a 2019 fall game or a 2020 game. You know, if the reality of
how you forget it was 2019 there for a minute.
Well, I think he means later 2019. Yeah, no, I'm with you, Jeff. I think that also what I would love for EA to start considering is the idea of early access. Like Fallout 76 could have been saved if Bethesda had just released it in early access and said, yo, this game's going to be broken, which they technically did ahead of Fallout 76.
They did do early access.
We're going to be fixing it. We're going to be adding things, but know that this isn't the full release. Same with Anthem. If they had said, hey, like there's still a lot of ideas we got in the can. It's not done yet, but we want to get it out there so we can workshop it with the community. We're in an era of transparency and vulnerability, and that's what people are yearning for and seeking from these companies and from people at large. And for some reason, these big companies still are resisting the idea of just being open and honest with their consumers. And I think that's really the root of the problem, is that consumers who are paying money for a product want it to be a good product. The developers who are making the product want it to be a good product. And when it's not, when either the consumer or the developer is unhappy, we just hope that they would be able to have an open line of dialogue and be able to communicate that with each other. But that's just not the way the business works. And that's the bummer part.
So well said. A beautiful, we'll leave it there. That is, I think, a profound thing, and one I hope lands with the higher ups. I fear that people won't recognize that truth, but yeah, to have, you know, have the developers sit literally on stage with you and say, oh, you know, I've had this vision for 5 years. And it's like behind the scenes, you know, they called it Anthem because they couldn't get the rights to the name they really wanted. And then somebody had to sort of retrofit a story for why it's called. It's like, just don't front, you know, don't pretend that everything is rosy and peachy keen and you're making the thing you've always wanted. If that's not the case, the consumer will go on that journey with you if you're, as you said, transparent, open, and honest. And I think that is the new currency. Certainly the currency of the internet is authenticity and honesty. And I think we're in an honesty crisis in this country. hopefully it turns around. Well, very well said, Andrea. And that's why I'm so glad that you were here to have us have that conversation with us. Let us, though, move on, because we have a lot of games to talk about that we've actually been playing. But first, I want to talk about our sponsor, Robinhood. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free. While other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. Plus, there's no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy-to-understand charts and market data, and place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections, such as the 100 most popular. With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio. Discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. Robinhood is giving listeners of DLC a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. Sign up at dlcpodcast.robinhood.com. That's dlcpodcast.robinhood.com. Time to talk about the games that we are playing. And Andrea, my goodness, you've been playing a lot. You've been at GDC, you've been at PAX East. So many great games to fill us in about. One I'd like to start with, actually, is the one I'm most curious about, because I was not able to make my meeting for this one at GDC, and that is Control. This is the new game from the people who have made some of my favorite games, Remedy. What did you think of you got hands-on with it, right, of Control?
I did. I got to play Control in a behind closed doors appointment back at the Game Developers Conference, and I got to have a nice lengthy chat with a couple members of the team from Remedy Entertainment as well. The game, from what I played, looks really good so far. It controls pretty good. The concept of the game, I'm still having trouble wrapping my head around, but I feel like that's Remedy in a nutshell. it's just the sci-fi elements of it are so weird and a little wacky that I'm just kind of like, wait, what's going on in this world? So let me pull up my notes here just to kind of refresh me everything. And I have some pretty extensive notes.
I'll give you a second to do that and say that when I saw this game at E3, not hands on, we just saw a sort of a preview of it with somebody else playing. I came away really worried about this game because I'm a huge fan of Remedy. I love the Max Payne series. I love the Alan Wake series. I root for them. And boy, the game did not give a good first impression to me. So I'm hoping, having played it, you came away a little more positive.
I definitely was in the same boat as you, that my first impressions weren't great, but now they are definitely better. So good news.
Good.
So for people who aren't familiar with this game, you play as a protagonist named Jessie Faden. She had a troubled childhood, discovered this supernatural force called the Hiss, which is kind of like the dark energy of the world. Through some kind of weird ritualistic process, she becomes the new director of this agency called the Bureau, because the previous director was killed. Don't know how. So everything takes place in, I think it's called the Old House. It's a really kind of weird setup where, you know, you're playing as this female character who's in charge of this division, but she doesn't really know what's happening inside. And there's clearly all this weird supernatural stuff going on.
And the house like moves and changes as you walk around it, right?
Right. So imagine it's like the inside of an office building. So it's not actually like styled like a house. It's styled more like a office complex, like a really big office building. And so you're kind of walking through these atrium areas, and then you'll be in more, you know, tight spaces like where cubicles are. And then you also visit this thing called the astral plane, which is like another dimension that you go in and out of. So that's a whole nother stylistic area to do some gameplay in. But at its heart, it's a third person like mystery adventure game that has some combat in it as well. But combat really isn't the focus of the game, though there is quite a bit of combat from what I've seen so far. And there's two ways that you can engage in combat. So you have a specialty gun that has its own skill tree, and then you have the ability to levitate items and throw them at enemies, which is pretty cool. The supernatural powers that you have are pretty fun. So you can be running around the world, and there's a lot of verticality going up and down stairs. And then you can also fly, for lack of a better word. And so you're essentially levitating. So for example, let's say I have my gun in my right hand, and I can use my left hand to levitate a desk, and I can throw the desk at an enemy and then shoot an enemy with my right hand, which is pretty cool. And then if I want to take it one step further, I can jump into the air and levitate in the air, and then pull like an office chair up while I'm in the air, and then like smash it down to people below me. It's pretty fun. So the idea of it, I'm still trying to wrap my head around, and like, where am I going? What am I doing? What's the point of it all? But I really like the style of the game. So the whole idea, obviously the name of the game is Control. So there's a lot of themes about being in control and losing control, both physical and psychological control. And that's like the kind of overarching theme in both the gameplay and the story. And so you're going to be visiting this history of what the Bureau is and the strange forces that the Bureau deals with and the deep mystery that kind of encourages speculation among the audience, but also weaves in this scientific desire to understand. These are the notes that I wrote down while I was watching the presentation. And so from my demo, I noticed that there's a skill tree system, that there's a, you know, interesting traversal system, and destruction is a big part of the game. So you'll be able to kind of tear down a lot of items throughout the environment.
It reminded me of, you know, there was a period in the sort of early 2000s when physics was just the new big thing in games. And it felt like every game you were able to levitate things with your mind and throw them around. And it felt kind of like a throwback to that to me. Were you having fun with just the pure mechanics of moving stuff around with your mind and shooting stuff? And was that layer fun, or did it feel a little old fashioned?
No, I was having fun with it. I did write in my notes, the movement and abilities feel very Matrix-esque.
Right, right.
kind of like
20-year-old movie.
Yeah, no, seriously though, but that's a good point. Is like, you know, it kind of feels like, oh, well, I'm in this weird world where I can kind of bend gravity. But it's interesting though that gravity was the one thing that they wanted to kind of ground in this world, because there's a lot of liberties with certain like rules of physics and things like that. But, you know, gravity was one of those rules that they wanted to kind of fall back on, which is great. But at the same time, it's, I mean, now that you mention it, like maybe it could definitely be construed as feeling a little dated. I will say the graphics felt a little bit more dated than I would appreciate for something that's coming out in 2019.
Yeah. Especially from Remedy, who feels like they've always pushed the boundary on that.
Yeah. And I want to be clear that this is a pre-release build that I played. This is not final code. And as it is with all pre-release, like it's very possible that they're going to polish it up and it's going to look a lot shinier and right. more sparkly once the final code is released. But to me, the hook of this game isn't the graphics, isn't the gameplay. It's the story. That's what Remedy is known for. And so I think that that's hopefully going to hold this game through. And I'm going to fully admit, I had no desire or interest in playing this game before I went to this demo. And now afterwards, I'm like, okay, I want to see what's going on here.
Well, that's good.
I'm intrigued.
So that's Control. And it is coming out, I think, pretty soon, right?
The end of the summer. Yeah, I think August 27th. I'd have to look that up for sure. But
what else? You have so many games that you've been playing. What else would you like to talk about?
Sure. So let's talk about one of the games I really loved that a lot of people haven't heard about is Trover Saves the Universe.
Yeah.
I had the absolute pleasure of working with Justin Roiland, the co-creator of Rick and Morty and co-founder of Squanch Games at PAX East, where I hosted a comedy and games writing panel with him on the main stage, which was super fun. We had a lot of great guests. And this isn't the first time I got to play Trover. It's actually like the fourth time I got to play Trover Saves the Universe. And what I love about this game is that not only is it really fun in PSVR virtual reality, but it also is available as a standard PS4 game as well. And the comedy in this game is just something that we just don't get enough of. I feel like really funny video games are kind of few and far between. And I chuckle and laugh out loud every time I play this game because I find something different. And even if you're not a big fan of Rick and Morty, you don't have to be to enjoy the humor in Trover Saves the Universe. I will say it's very foul-mouthed. Lots of swearing, so certainly not one for the kids, I would say. But it doesn't have that kind of grotesque-esque-ness to its humor the way like South Park The Fractured Butthole did, for example.
Right.
Like, that game was funny too, but like I think that those guys tend to go in a more like bathroom humor way than Trover Saves the Universe does. And so I just really like the game. You essentially play as this Chair Orpian, I think he called it, where you're controlling this character named Trover, who has been tasked with saving the universe from this big boss enemy of Vlorkon, I think his name is, or Vorkon, something like that. And it's just hilarious. You have these little power babies that are going your eye sockets, and you have to go around the world and collect them. And in order to level them up, they like eat each other. And it's just like, it's wacky. It's just wackadoo. And I really had a good time playing it. So, and that game comes out so soon at the end of May. And so if you're looking for like a nice, like relatively short breath of fresh air, that's going to make you laugh and it's going to be just a silly good time, definitely check out some previews of Trover Saves the Universe.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, that guy's sense of humor is so fun. And clearly is a fan of VR because he's done several VR games now. So
yeah, they have done a couple. And you know, the team at Squanch is just so fun because they know that they're obviously working with Justin, who's got obligations to his TV show, but they're like, it's just like such a fun work environment. And a lot of times they kind of do things on the fly really quickly. And because they built that game, the animation of that game, to be relatively quick on the turn, sometimes, you know, they talk to me about some stories about how Justin would just go into the VO booth and he's like, I just got this idea for some lines, and he'll just like record them and they'll be able to turn around some animation and like pump it into the game relatively quickly because of how simple they made the animation style in the game. And I'm like, that's so cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. I know both you and Christian have been playing Yoshi's Crafted World on Switch. What is your take, both of you, on that game? Is it just as delightful and whimsical as I would want?
I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't know, Christian, if you want to go first here, but whimsical is a great word. Delightful is a great word. A word I might use also is boring, maybe.
Oh no. That's an antonym to whimsical and delightful.
Christian, what do you think?
I love it. I think it is magic, and it is stunningly beautiful. The way that Nintendo has used kind of that tilt shift perspective to create this diorama world that, you know, looks like your kids could make, like cardboard cutouts and pieces stuck together and birds coming in on strings or straws or pipe cleaners. And it holds on to, I haven't finished the game, but what I've played, the hours I've put into it, I mean, it holds on to this theme and doubles down on it in really cool ways. There's underwater levels that aren't underwater. You know, they're only underwater in backdrop name only, where it's like, oh, now the cardboard is painted like a fish, but you're not in water. Cardboard would get ruined underwater. You know, what are you doing? And the little outfits you have that work as shields, I think they could be implemented in a greater way throughout the game also. But they're so well made and crafted. And I think the care put into how could we have actually built this world. And Nintendo's been doing this for a while now with Woolly World and Yarn.
Is that Kirby?
Yeah. Like just exquisite art direction in these games. And what I really like about Yoshi's Crafted World is it's not, you know, difficult in the way Celeste or New Super Mario Brothers U, those games are, or even Odyssey has some fairly challenging later levels, I think, and harder challenges, especially if you're going to complete the game. But it is just it's kind of like going on Peter Pan at Disneyland or Disney World, right? Like, it's not going to blow your mind with a loop or anything like that or death-defying spin, but it is so well put together. The music, the animation, the care to detail to the world that you're in and everything that you interact with. And it is unrelenting joy, in my opinion. And I like that it is probably one of the slowest Mario games I've played, where I feel like they're really trying to have you see the world, and it's definitely not, you know, Mario speed where you're kind of running through and you can bounce off things and launch to here and then triple jump up to this thing. And even some of the other Yoshi games and Kirby games where you can really string together and get moving pretty quickly. I think Kirby, the last Kirby Switch game, was a little slower as well. But you're walking through this environment, trying to collect everything that you can, aiming your eggs into the foreground and background. Some of the levels, in order to complete them, you kind of need to replay them to get a different perspective on them. And it's just a wonderful world that I want to live in and experience. So it's not, you know, challenging my dexterity. It's not trying on my brain to figure out how to solve this puzzle, but it is just such a wonderful experience that I love it. I've been playing it by myself. My kids got mad at me when we were playing. I'm like, oh, we got to stop. We got to get ready to go to school. And then I played more during the day and they came back and they're like, hey, this isn't where we stopped. Busted. But I can't recommend it enough. I think it is pure joy put onto a little Switch cart, or I guess download code.
So Andrea, tell me why you're finding it to be a little boring. Is it that speed and lack of challenge, or
And then I appreciate Christian's perspective a lot. I think what he said about how they're intentionally slowing it down so you can see the painstaking care they put into the art direction is a very good point to bring up. But I think I've just been so trained to kind of want to speed run these worlds and like get through them and just keep going from that side scrolling life that I just don't stop to look at stuff. And maybe that's on me as the player. And I absolutely echo everything he said about the art direction and the art style. It's amazing. And the cute factor of Yoshi being in the game is and being the lead character cannot be understated. I mean, all the sounds Yoshi makes and the way he jumps around, he's just a cute little guy, right? And so I like the idea of a Yoshi-driven game. But for me, I'm not playing it with children. And so I'm looking, and after having the last platformer I played was Celeste. So I'm like, I'm looking for something a little bit more intensive from a mechanics gameplay perspective. And they do have two difficulty modes, but I was on the more difficult of the two modes. And it still didn't feel difficult. But like the formula, I think, is just something that's a little too samey when it comes to these Nintendo platformers about like you're going to go through the world and you have to collect these special colored coins and then you have to collect these special sunflowers. And then there's going to be like a hidden tunnel over here. And then you're going to have to double jump to get it to an area here. It's like Nintendo's been making this style of game for a very long time. And they have it down to polished perfection. For sure. And they absolutely deserve credit for that. But I think the one kind of byproduct of that is that there's not much a lot of innovation in the style of platformer that they're doing, particularly with this game. Now, maybe they have something up their sleeve for whatever's coming for Mario or Metroid down the ramp. But Yoshi's Crafted World is not bringing the innovation. But it is bringing the goods when it comes to the cute factor, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about a couple more of your, you know, sort of GDC PAX experiences. What are the best couple of things that you saw there?
Sure. So one of the games that I noticed that Christian also tried, but you can talk about it or you can't talk about Dangerous Driving?
We can talk about it. Yeah, we can talk about it.
So I got to play this game at PAX East for the first time, and I'd heard about Three Fields and what they were working on. So, of course, this is led by Fiona Sperry and Alex Ward, previously of Criterion, and they left EA and kind of took all of their Burnout franchise experience with them because they believe in the vision of what an arcade racer should look like. And clearly EA was like, well, we're going to be making Need for Speed. And so they, you know, shook hands and left and went to start their own studio. And now we've got Dangerous Driving, which is coming out this week, I believe, April 11th, I think is the release date. Let me double check that. But so whenever I heard that it was, you know, Alex and the team and the folks from Criterion and they're making essentially the spiritual successor to Burnout, I was like, I must play this game.
It's Burnout.
Yeah. It's full on Burnout. And what I love is that it's like classic Burnout. And I wanted to be clear because I kind of got into a heated Twitter debate with some people who are watching the gameplay previews that are now coming out from PAX East. I mean, like, it doesn't look like Burnout. I go, no, this definitely looks like classic Burnout. It's not Burnout Paradise. You know, like, that's not mince words. It's not that. But if you love Burnout 2, Burnout 3, or if you like Burnout Revenge like me, like, this game is going to be right up your alley. I had a blast playing this game.
And I think it's $26. I think it's a sort of budget title. Yeah. They previously made a sort of Burnout Crash Mode game.
Danger Zone.
Right. And so now this is like Burnout with tracks and cars that you unlock and takedowns and the stuff that, I mean, it really is Burnout 2. Christian, you and I both got codes to play this game. What is your feelings on Dangerous Driving?
I feel like Andrea and I are on opposite sides of a mirror today, and I'm trying to find a way when we'll break through. I agree that it feels like it doesn't, you don't need to parse it, but Burnout 3 to me is the Burnout that I would label it.
Oh, not 2? All right.
I'd go more Burnout 3. Maybe Revenge also.
It's not Revenge. No. It is not Burnout Revenge for sure. It doesn't keep track of your like takedowns like that, and I don't know.
Only no. In certain modes, like right. The road rage mode is specifically about takedowns, yeah.
Right. So there's it has that kind of pedigree to it. So I think that aspect of the game, if you're looking for that, kind of nostalgia, or you want that. And again, I think you said we got codes for this. It feels like a game that didn't have either enough time or budget behind it. I think, unfortunately, where I think if I had played this as a hands-on demo somewhere, I'd be like, keep an eye on this game. Having played a review, you know, I think essentially final version of the game, it feels like the font, it's little things and they kind of just don't coalesce together.
Did you say the font?
The font's used. Yeah, it feels like a free font, like HD font, like, and I think that is a minor example, but I think it's bigger to the crashes don't feel impactful enough. Like the car kind of crumples and turns on its side, but it doesn't explode. And you know, the way Burnout got to with these big, especially at the time, those things were jaw droppers, right? Like on Xbox 360, I think it was, it would take, if you had your webcam, it would take a picture of your face reacting to it because they were like, oh no. And here it just kind of felt like the sound wasn't big enough, the crash wasn't big enough. When the game is paused, it's an Unreal Engine game, I think it looks beautiful, but in motion it feels flat. The controls feel I don't want depth. I'm looking for Forza, but it's kind of like you're turning or you're not turning, and you can just slide against a wall for a long time. Little things like, if I guess a real road would have
you
this.
You now know how to drift.
You can drift.
I'm listening to you describe all these things, and I'm like, yeah, but this is an arcade racing game. Like, it's not intended to be simulation. It's not intended to be this over-the-top bombastic thing.
Well, I think it's intended to be over the top.
I think I just went in with my expectations set in the right place of, like, this is going to be like an arcade-style racing game. This isn't Forza Horizon. And I don't know. I just walked away feeling good. I had a blast.
Well, that's great. I think that I have often said over and over and over through the years how much I love Burnout as a franchise. I'm not a racing guy. Like, Christian's a real racing game guy. I'm not a racing game guy.
Oh, that's why he's getting so snobby. That makes sense.
I'm a Burnout guy. Well, don't get too crazy, Andrea. I'm about to agree with him a little bit. I'm a Burnout guy. And so I love that Burnout, that somebody's making basically a Burnout game. But this feels like a cover band. It feels like a cover band for Burnout. And there's part of me that's like, yeah, nobody's making Burnout right now, so these guys are making Burnout. That's great. But also I feel like, well, but Burnout Paradise is backwards compatible on my Xbox. I can just play that if I want to just redo Burnout. I feel like I wish they had gone, here are some ideas that we weren't able to do in Burnout, or here's the next place that Burnout can go, or there's something fresh to do here that is not just a cover band of Burnout. And like I said, I love Burnout, and I wish that there were new Burnout games being made, and this kind of is a new Burnout game, but it doesn't feel like it's the next step. It feels like, hey, remember Burnout? Wasn't that great? Wouldn't it be great if somebody made that again? It's like, but you don't need to make it again. I don't know. I just felt it doesn't feel fully baked, you know?
Yeah. I think it's important to remind people listening about who Three Fields is and like how small they are.
Right.
So I think the last time I checked, they were literally a 7-person studio. And they are completely independent. And so they have an incredibly small team, and that they even say, you know, openly on like their About Us section on the website that the games are stepping stones to the future. We're not there yet, but every game we make adds more and more features. And so I think it's like, to take with a grain of salt, like, you're not going to get this crazy game with all of these physics and visual fidelity and these things that, you know, gamers have come to expect maybe from an arcade racing game, because this is more of an indie style game. It's meant to be small from a small team. And that's why they priced it, you know, appropriately. I think if they had come out and said that this was a $59.99 game, they would get crucified. And so they were like, no, this isn't a full game. Like, it's meant to be a short experience. So, and like, in fairness, I haven't played with the same code that you played with. I don't know if the code we played was the same. So maybe when I finally get the final code, I'll come back and be like, oh, well, maybe I'm a little bit more disappointed, but I don't know, man. I'm, I'm having a tough time hearing you guys rag on it.
Well, no, I think you make great points. That is an excellent point.
Sorry. Go ahead.
She's making a great point. The counterpoint is it's in the marketplace with all those other things, but you're right. It is at a cheaper price point. I'm rooting for those guys. I want them to be able to expand and really take on the behemoths, stand shoulder to shoulder with the next Need for Speed or whatever game is their competition. I would love for them to make a full on, feature parody kind of AAA racer. And this is a little bit step back, but it is priced appropriately, as you said, and they're a small team. So I'm rooting for them. It just feels like, if you go to a secondhand store and get Burnout Paradise for Xbox 360 and put it in your Xbox One and it downloads the patch for free and you get to play that game with updated, resolution, it's hard to recommend this over that.
They also released a remastered Burnout Paradise.
Also, you could buy that. Yes.
And so I played it as various types of cars, a sedan, a sports car, or like a high-end car. They felt almost exactly the same. The sense of speed felt very similar. The drifting felt very similar. The crashes weren't any more elaborate. And I think their heart is 100% in the right place, and I want them to keep making games. I don't think my critiques with this game are about critiques of the people or the team or the passion behind it or the idea behind it. But I feel like saying that, because this is a small team, we need to judge it differently, I think is a discredit to what we're looking at. I'm not reviewing, can one person make something that's pretty good? Like, from what I've played of this game, it is not worth your time.
I think from my perspective, and like they have four different types of cars, there's four different levels of cars. And then within each of those four archetypes, there's a variety of different types of vehicles, and the types of cars are tuned specifically for different modes. So there's a special class of car that's specifically for road rage and takedowns that has a little bit heavier chassis and can withstand more damage. And then they have ones that are designed for racing that have higher speeds of acceleration and can go, faster, but they withstand obviously less damage. Your typical racing stuff. I think when I look at this game and I've played it, it harkens me back to my countless hours playing one of my favorite arcade racing games of all time, Cruisin' USA, and thinking I loved playing that game to see how fast I could go without crashing, but I didn't care what kind of tires I had, what kind of torque they had, what kind of, body the car had, if it went faster or slower, because it wasn't for me. It was never about that. And that's what's been so tough for me to get into modern racing games, because it's all about the gearhead aspect of building your vehicle, like from the nuts and bolts up. And I don't want any of that. I want to put a fancy racing stripe on my car. I want to pick the paint color, and that's it. That's all I care about when it comes to picking the stats on a car. So I guess from my perspective, I'm like, I don't care that they all feel the same.
Yeah. I hear you.
Productive, but like, I don't know.
I'm on that page of wanting a why should I ever not be holding down the gas in a racing game? That's how I play a racing game. So I'm a bad judge of that as well. But
that's what this game is, Jeff. That's the whole point of a game like this, is that you get to endlessly boost over and over again. And it's not meant to be simulation at all. And that's what I think is so fun about it. I've been dying for a game like this. I want to be able to crash into stuff without having it ruin my whole racing experience.
Yeah. No, I had like three crashes in a race and I still finished first.
Feel good?
It felt good. That is Dangerous Driving, and it is out this week. I want to talk about a game that I was actually informed of last week. It's not on my radar, but boy, it got its hooks into me this week. Last week, Anthony Taormina was on. He told me about Risk of Rain 2, which is just tearing it up over on Steam with great reviews and many more downloads than the Risk of Rain team thought. I played the first Risk of Rain a fair amount, which was a 2D side-scrolling roguelike shooter. It's fun. But man, Risk of Rain 2 is just a quantum leap. I always say that. Quantum is a very small thing. It was a huge leap, not a quantum leap, a huge leap in quality, in ambition, in execution. I'm digging it, man. It's only in early access now, so there's a lot more content coming, and I'm excited to see where it goes, but very happy that I purchased in on the early access. So what it is a true roguelike. Every time you boot up the game, you are starting fresh from ground zero, although you can unlock things that let you start with new characters and stuff for subsequent runs. But you start in these environments. It's a full third-person 3D action game with ranged combat. It's a shooter. And you teleport in with you and three of your compatriots. It's full co-op for up to four people. And you start blasting everything in sight. Everything in sight, you start blasting. And then there is a meter at the top that is informing you that the game is slowly getting more difficult. So you start with easy and just a pure time. It is a pure how long can you survive as the game gets more difficult. And you're searching through these levels for a teleporter that will get you to the next level. But you soon, I mean, if you can stay alive long enough, you will get to the last level that they've made so far, and then you will take a teleporter that'll loop you back to the first level and you'll keep going as long as you can survive. And the meter at the top will tell you you've moved from easy to medium to hard to insane to there's ridiculous descriptions of how difficult it gets, all the way up to just it says ha 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 infinitely because of how insane the hard it is. And you're trying to survive, and you get power-ups, and you're buying. You get money every time you kill something. They spit out money. You can use that money to purchase things at certain kiosks that are littered around the environment. It's all random, all procedurally generated, and the enemies get crazier and crazier and crazier. And the items that you get, your power-ups, your power gets more and more, so you're able to handle the crazy as it ramps up. So it's a very basic gameplay loop, a pure roguelike, but the joy is in collecting all of these wacky power-ups that make you feel OP all the time. And the brilliant part of this game, the thing that I find extremely satisfying, is that every single power-up that you get, and you get a lot of them, and they all stack. There's nothing that getting one thing makes you get rid of another thing. They all just continue to rack up on the top line of your screen. It just shows you the 20, 30, 40 power-ups that you get if you can stay alive long enough. And every single one of them has a visual representation on your character. It is so satisfying to see you all of a sudden have a bandolier on your character, or have something hanging from your belt, or a new headdress, or some weird thing on your arm, or one of your bullets turns into a grenade and explodes, or something shooting an enemy and killing them makes them catch fire and explode, and that carries to all the enemies around it. All of it visually represented, all of it super satisfying. The level of chaos and insanity just seems to have no bounds. And I find the game very, very fun. It's a great game to jump into with friends. I think all of the praise that Risk of Rain 2 is getting is well-deserved, and I'm super excited to see where this team goes now that they are selling way more copies. I guess it sold 500,000 copies in its first week, which is far beyond what they expected, and I'm hoping they channel that into continuing to update this game and polish it for a full release with lots more content, because it's a blast. I'm really enjoying Risk of Rain 2. All right. Well, that's what we've been playing. Andrew, is there anything else you want to throw in at the end here? I know you have so many things that you've been playing. Is there any other parting experiences from GDC or PAX East that you wanted to not forget?
Yes, quickly, I'm going to try to go over it as fast as possible. Journey to the Savage Planet. And the reason I want to talk about this is because not a lot of people have heard about this game or played it. Have either of you seen it or heard about it?
Yes, I fell deeply, madly in love with it at GDC. Yes.
Oh, good. So you did get to see it. So This is Alex Hutchinson's game he's co-making, and I always forget his partner's name whenever I bring it up, but it's Typhoon Studios is the name of the development team that is working on it, and I know Alex because I got to work with him several times during his tenure at Ubisoft. He was the game director for Assassin's Creed 3, and he also led Far Cry 4. He has worked on games like Spore and Splinter Cell, so he has like a long history, as with the rest of his team in the video game space, but they really wanted to do something different. And the notes that I have from his demonstration were optimistic, upbeat, positive, exploration focused. It's an earnest comedy that's an exploration action adventure where you play a human with an AI assistant, and it's designed to be short. It's only about 10 to 15 hours of exploration. Kind of an aperitif, he called it, not a full priced game. And what I love the most about it is that they just decided to make it a bespoke game. So it is exploration focused, but this isn't No Man's Sky where there's endless amounts of procedural generation. Everything in the world is painstakingly placed there. I have a quote from Alex that says, if you're going to spend time climbing a mountain to turn over a rock, you want something that was intentionally put there.
Yes, I agree 100%.
So I just like what I loved about it is that it really had a kind of cartoon vibe from the Rare and retro games of old and felt whimsical in that way for sure. And the comedy in it was very understated, but very on the nose in certain aspects. So lots of laugh out loud moments during our demo. And it just looks super fun. And we just don't get enough games that are optimistic, upbeat, positive.
Agreed.
You know?
Agreed.
So I'm really looking forward to seeing more of this. Sadly, not coming for a little while. They said early 2020 is what they're targeting, but
yeah, it looks so fun. And I came out just like so happy for those guys. Like they all quit very high paying jobs making, you know, the Battlefields and the Army of Twos. And, you know, they were all making top tier games, all these dudes. And like, let's go and make something that's a little closer to our heart and not, you know, it just feels a more earnest and, as you said, upbeat and positive. Kudos to that impulse. And, yeah, I came away just in love with the sentiment of those guys, and the game itself looks like something I'm really going to enjoy. You know, goofy stuff, but pure exploration and in a really interesting looking world. So, yeah, totally agree. Very much worth mentioning. Christian, you also had a game that you wanted to bring up before we move on.
Yeah, I wanted to talk some Mextermination Force, which is the new game from I'm gonna ruin his name, and I apologize. Bertil Hoberg. He made Gunman Clive, which if you want to get in your way back machine, I talked about Gunman Clive 2 on episode 61 over 4 years ago. I was singing its praises then. I was given a code for this game. I should say that. I love this game with my whole heart.
And nice.
To let people know if it's not on their radar or anything, you know the types of games I like. Platformers, Celeste. I'm getting into retro gaming again in a big way. And this feels like Gunman Clive was kind of a side scroller shoot, constantly shooting, smaller games, played them on 3DS, really. They were cheap, but really well done and really fun experiences. And Mextermination Force is like if Contra maybe 3, maybe Super Contra, was just a boss rush game. So different than Cuphead, which also, you know, they added some side-scrolling parts to that game, but also is very much focused on being a boss rush game. Mextermination Force is kind of that Super Contra, Contra 2 or Contra 3 approach to it, where you're constantly shooting and blasting up against this huge boss and trying to whittle it down as it evolves through kind of each stage of combat. So you'll shoot the armor off the leg. Later you get Gatling gloves that help you climb that are magnetic. So you shoot the armor off the leg, you climb inside this huge mech robot's body. That the graphic style is, it's polygonal 3D, but it's very cute. It's very whimsical in its approach to it. It's not trying to live in realism of like these huge mechs are smashing our city. It's very kind of tongue in cheek and fun and bright colors. And so you, one is like a, it looks like a cowboy. It has cowboy boots and spurs and is very lanky and kind of almost marionette-esque dancing in the middle of the city. And you'll shoot the armor off its leg, scamper inside, then it has defense turrets inside that you'll need to take down or kind of dodge the bullet hell that's coming at you as you're climbing up this thing to take down the next weak point to climb up. And you always need to defeat the red orbs, you know, the weak spots that are very clearly marked. It's not trying to hide the ball with what you're trying to do per se, or when you get there with your huge wrench. So you have to get close enough to do a melee combat to take these things down. And each time you kind of get through various parts of the bosses, how you have to, the strategy changes. It will start floating, or the leg will go away, or will transform into this other type thing. There's a boss that starts off looking like a huge mechanical snail, and then by the end of it, I think it's like three pieces of metal floating in the sky that are circling around each other that you need to stay magnetized to as you jump from one to the other to kind of get to the weak point. And what I love about it so much is that it is the type of game that, unlike for me in Cuphead, where sometimes I felt like I never had a chance, like I needed to literally sit down and just memorize this pattern, otherwise I'm never going to get through it. The bosses that I've come up against in, which is the game, the mechs that I fight and Mextermination Force, I feel like I have a chance my first try. I almost never get through them on my first try, but there's that feeling of, and this bullet's going to get here and I can climb this and I don't need to just sit and memorize the attack pattern for how to progress. And the other thing I really like about this difficult style Contra-esque game is that the money you collect as you fight bosses, even when you fail, it keeps adding up. So you're able to take that money and go back to the shop and buy hearts or new weapons. And so it's the opposite of like a Bloodborne where it's like you die, you lose everything. Here it's like you die, but you still got all that money you got. So maybe go buy a couple of heart containers for this, you know, a one-time use heart container to use for this boss because it's handed you your butt a couple of times in a row now. And it's the type of game that I don't realize I'm gripping my Switch too hard until I've been playing for an hour. And then I put it down and I'm like, why do my hands hurt? It's like that good, like I'm squeezing the console so hard in my hand as I'm focused. Like, I can do it. If that bullet, I'm going to climb up, I'm going to hit. Yes. And then I put the Switch down and your hands are still stuck in that position. It's awesome. If you like games like Contra, I think Cuphead, if it kind of scratches that itch for people as well, it is a charming, difficult, Contra-like bullet hell boss rush game that is just absolutely magical. I really, really like it.
That is Mextermination Force, and you're playing it on Switch.
Yeah, buddy.
All right. It's time to thank our other sponsor, and that is HelloFresh. Oh, my gosh. I've been loving HelloFresh. The wife and I decided to get the HelloFresh family pack. Who knew? We have a family. It's for four people. Two of my four people are very small people and barely eat human food. They do eat human food, but just not very big portions. But it has been such a delight with HelloFresh to get the family pack. Let me tell you about HelloFresh. HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service, shops, plans, and delivers step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can just cook, eat, and enjoy. Enjoy we have, I tell you. I love being able to cook for my family. I love not having to shop or decide on what we're going to eat. But man, these family meals have been so good, and there's so much food. I cannot believe it. I had leftovers. I brought leftovers to work the next day. It was amazing. We had bibimbap, which I don't know if you guys have had bibimbap, but I love bibimbap. I've never made it myself.
Oh, it's delicious.
Oh, yeah, the best. I've never made it myself, though, and I could because of HelloFresh. I made my own bibimbap. It was even better the next day. We also had something called Amazing Apricot Chicken, which was truly amazing. I could not believe it. The thing that's so cool is they come in pre-packaged, pre-portioned little paper bags. So all you have to do when you get the box, pull out the paper bag, put it in the fridge. Nothing else. So easy. So cool. You spend less time planning your meals. You spend no time grocery shopping for those meals because it all comes to your house. You get that time back to do more of what you want to do. And you you have options. There are these three plans to choose from: classic, veggie, and family. Like I said, we did the family one, but you can switch between them when your tastes change, because maybe we're not going to need four people's worth of food every week. You have that veggie option, which is awesome. And these are, don't take a million years to make. These are 30-minute max recipes, call for less than two pots and pans. So you don't have to spend a lot of time cleaning up either. You get seasonal recipes. You get, stuff that they have put together. It adds variety to my menu, my life. I love it. I love it. And I want you to love it. So check this out. You can get $80 off your first month of HelloFresh by going to HelloFresh.com/DLC80. And then you enter promo code DLC80. Remember that, because it's $80 off your first month. It's like receiving eight meals for free. So again, $20 off your first four boxes. Go to HelloFresh.com/DLC80 and enter DLC80 at checkout. Very cool stuff. All right, I want to do a quick VR segment because, Andrea, I know that at GDC you got a chance to try out some Oculus Quest and some of the upcoming games that are coming out to Oculus. So what was your impression of Oculus Quest?
It was pretty life-changing, I'm not going to lie. I have been very hesitant in my VR game playing because of all the setup. We finally decided to dedicate a PS4 Pro for our PSVR here at the Drake household, nice. Which was certainly a step in the right direction so that we're not like moving the cables around all the time. I mean, because in this busy day and age, one minor inconvenience means I just don't play VR.
Right.
What I was really impressed by with the Oculus Quest, which of course is wireless VR, was just how good it felt. Because for the longest time, the Rift headset was incredibly uncomfortable on my face because I have a very tiny head. And so I really have to clamp the headset down pretty aggressively in order to make sure it sits properly on the bridge of my nose so it's not fuzzy inside the headset. And so it was really uncomfortable for me to wear for more than 20 minutes or so. And I didn't feel that with the Quest, which was nice. So they have this new knob in the back that just like you turn it and then it like clicks and then like automatically adjusts everything. There's not all these individual straps. And I was like, okay. Am I talking about the S?
The S has the clamp on the back, and the Quest, the standalone Quest, has the two Velcro straps on the side.
Okay. So I played both of them. Yeah. So the S knob. Amazing. What I loved about playing, so I played Beat Saber specifically in the Oculus Quest, and that is a very motion intensive game. Some VR games, you know, you just sit and you hold your controller, you play at your mouse and keyboard or whatever, right? But like this was amazing because I had the little, what's the name of the Oculus controllers again?
Touch.
The touch controllers in my hands. And I'm just like, you know, slashing these notes left and right. I'm playing, the song I played was KDA's Pop Stars, and I'm just like getting into it. And it was so much fun to be able to move around and not feel the tug of the cable. Because I tangled all the time.
At my meeting, Andrea, I literally had to apologize for the amount of sweat that I was letting out. I was like, I'm really sorry. I only know one way to play this game, and it's 100%. So I'm sorry. I don't know. I'm sweating everywhere. You're going to need a cleaning crew in here. But yeah, I agree. Not having cables is a game changer specifically for that game.
Yeah. So it was super fun. I love that they're launching with a pretty comprehensive library. And the price point, I think, is, you know, a little bit doable now. I mean, I know it's still $399, which is still a lot of money, but you don't have to have a PC now. And it's not like PSVR where you have to have a PlayStation. Yeah. Like it's just all right there in the headset. And the audio comes from inside the band, which is really neat.
That is the one thing I forgot to mention when I brought this up on the show after GDC, is how remarkable it is to hear audio but have no thing in your ear or covering your ear. Mm-hmm. It's really wild. It's an amazing thing to have clear, crisp, you know, stereo audio, surround, positional audio, but my ears are completely open to the air, which is just a wild thing.
Yeah, it was super impressive. And I wasn't a believer in the Rift before, but man, Oculus Quest has made me a believer. So I'm definitely excited to spend some more time in virtual reality because of the Quest. And then conversely, the time I spent in the Rift S, I was not prepared for how beautiful Stormland looked. So did you get a chance to play Stormland?
I did. Yeah, that's the new Insomniac VR game where you play as a robot. I was very impressed with it also.
I think I'm sure you've talked about it already, but the one thing I want to mention is I have never seen a virtual reality game's graphics look this good, because there's just always something inherently a little off about VR graphics that just, you know, I'm just so used to seeing a lot of things either in 1080p or in 4K these days. And I'm really impressed with what Insomniac has been able to achieve with the Rift S. Obviously, you know, they've put several VR titles out, so they're very comfortable with working in the space, and definitely looking forward to seeing more from this game.
Yeah, I mean, the moment where you like step off of a cliff and put your arms out and fly forward among the clouds is pretty rad. Like pulling off your own arm and replacing it with a new arm is pretty rad. And just looking down at yourself and seeing a robot body and being able to look through your arm and hold it up. I'm very, very excited for Stormland. And it's going to be like a full, big, awesome adventure game. It's looks great. Speaking of full, big, awesome adventure games, I finally got a chance to go back and revisit Borderlands 2 VR since they added support for the AIM controller. And ladies and gentlemen, it is a game changer. It is the only way to play. I hope that Sony realizes what an asset the AIM controller is to their VR. It sets it apart from Oculus, from Vive, from any of the other players in the space. Because I think the motion controllers, the Move controllers that they use are clearly the least, the least good solution. They were retrofit from old tech and just not ideal. But man, the AIM controller is better than a lot of them. There's not an equivalent available on those other PC platforms. And I hope Sony doubles down on this, because a game like Borderlands 2, I know this is going to, you guys will have to take this with a grain of salt coming from me, a person who loves VR, but I think this is the best way to play Borderlands. I'm holding a gun controller in my hand and running through a fully 3D immersive environment, turning and shooting things, picking up awesome weapons, holding them up, looking at that weapon super close in my hand and inspecting it because each weapon is different. And then it is awesome. It's awesome. I want to play through all of Borderlands 2 again with this AIM controller, because it's so much fun to just run at a guy, shoot my shotgun in his face. The controls map really, really well to the AIM controller. It's a game changer. It is fantastic. So there you go. That's going to do it for this episode. We do have our parting gifts coming up, so stay tuned for that. But Andrea Renee, it is always a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. I didn't realize it had been so long since we had done this. Thanks for the invite. So good to talk to you, gents, as always.
Absolutely. And tell people where they can keep up with you and your myriad activities online.
Well, you can find me at whatsgoodgames.com. You can download the What's Good Games podcast wherever you listen to DLC. You can also check us out at youtube.com/whatsgoodgames. And then I also host a couple times a week with the fine folks over at Kinda Funny Games. So you can watch us live. I'm generally there on Tuesdays and Thursdays, twitch.tv/kindafunnygames at 10 a.m. Pacific time. Or you can also find them on podcast services and YouTube as well. And you can find me and all the things I'm up to at Andrea Renee on Twitter.
Very, very cool. Christian Spicer, how about you? What do you got going on this week?
Twitter's the best way to keep in touch. It's at Spicer. I know I say I stream this show live on my Twitch, which is twitch.tv/Christian Spicer. But we haven't the past few weeks or this week, but I think we're going to start again in 2 p.m. Sundays, right?
It's the new normal. It's the new, it's we're in a Game of Thrones world. We got to make way for Game of Thrones. It's priorities.
Winter has come, I guess, and it's moved DLC's recording time.
That's what
happened. So Sundays at 2 p.m., there will be a few caveats here and there because of prior commitments that I have, but Sundays 2 p.m., I will do my best to stream the show live on my Twitch. Jeff, what about you?
Well, you can always follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. And I do another podcast all about movies and TV shows called the Slash Filmcast, which you can find at slashfilmcast.com. This week, we're going to be talking about Shazam, which is really good, really fun. You can find that wherever you get podcasts as well. Oh, also, I should mention, because it has become public and it was a big announcement and I'm kind of proud of it, I am going to be a voice in a VR game, the upcoming Vacation Simulator from Alchemy Labs. Thank you.
Woohoo! Yeah.
I'm so excited. Erika Ishii is the other voice. And so we're sort of the two big leads that you go through the whole game with. It was like a dream come true for me. I'm excited. I really loved Job Simulator, which was their first VR game. And now this is the sequel. So if you want to hear me as a robot, get that game and like tell me what you think.
You got a job to help me go on vacation.
That's right. Okay, that's it. Oh, also you can always email us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. But let's wrap the show up now with our parting gifts. Hey, give us a suggestion. Andrea Renee, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
I have been obsessed with the new season of Queer Eye on Netflix. I don't know if you guys have talked about this or seen it. Please tell me you've seen some Queer Eye.
This is the second season of the new reboot, right?
The third season, actually.
I watched some of the first season and I enjoyed what I saw, but I didn't stick with it. Everybody I've heard talk about this says that you will just bawl your eyes out.
That's not true. I have yet to cry. I have teared up a couple times, but it's all happy tears. Let me be clear.
Right.
And the reason why I want to suggest this is because it feels like there's fewer and fewer purely positive experiences on television these days. And so much of reality TV centers around conflict and gossip and he said, she said, and backstabbing. And Queer Eye is none of that. And what I love about the way that they've evolved the show from its original days back as Queer Eye for the Straight Guy on Bravo is that this is no longer about telling people how they should live their life or the way they should look or what they should eat. This is about helping people realize the best version of themselves that they maybe have lost along the way because of a hardship that they suffered or a grief that they're going through, or maybe they just got a bad hand of cards dealt to them and they've just struggled to overcome it. And this team comes in and says, hey, we're going to help you rediscover your best self and we're going to help you remember how amazing you are just the way you are. And I just love that message so much that I'm getting a little teary-eyed thinking about it. But like, it's such a feel-good show. And that cast, this new crew of guys that they have on it are just such wonderful people to watch on camera. And I think that there's some really good nuggets of wisdom and life lessons to take away from that show. So if you've been not maybe waiting in the wings and you're like, oh, I've heard people talk about it, I really just urge you to at least watch a single episode and hopefully you'll get hooked.
Queer Eye, more like Tear Eye. Am I right? that is Queer Eye and it is on Netflix. Christian Spicer, what's your parting gift?
Well, I don't want to spoil a Slash Filmcast for people. I haven't listened to it, but I will wholeheartedly recommend Shazam. It is such a fun movie. There's one
superhero movie that's fun. What?
It's so fun. There's one scene in it that I think makes it maybe inappropriate for younger kids, but you know, do some due diligence. But otherwise, I think the movie is a really fun movie for young kids also. I think it's got a good message. It's funny. The action is great. The special effects are great. My only minor nit with it is I wish that like one scene didn't happen, because then I'd be like, 6-year-old, we're going to the movies.
It bums me out that the movie's PG-13. I feel like they wanted the PG-13 because it sort of gives them a little street cred in a weird way. I can't have a superhero movie that's PG, but man, it should be PG. It should be a movie straight up made for 7-year-olds.
Yeah, Spider-Verse is PG. You can do it.
Yeah, it's a bummer. There's no reason that movie should be PG-13. It didn't need to.
Yeah, but all that being said, go see it. I think Zachary Levi is great. Levi is great in it. The cast is phenomenal. It's well written, well acted, and beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. I really enjoyed Shazam.
Agreed. I got a listener suggested parting gift. This was sent to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. This comes from Colin. Colin says, fan of the show and first suggestion for a parting gift. The band Newfound Glory is releasing a cover album of songs made famous by movies in May called From the Screen to Your Stereo 3. And they've released a couple of singles in preparation. Last month, they released a cover of Power of Love by Huey Lewis and the News. Power of Love, curious thing, which was pretty good. But last week, they released a cover of This Is Me from the movie The Greatest Showman. This is a brilliant cover, and I cannot stop listening to it. If you're even remotely a fan of pop punk, the original song, or just appreciate a quality cover, you should give it a listen. Keep up the great work, Colin. Hey, Christian, I think you're a fan of pop punk.
NFG, never heard of them, never went on tour with them, and never worked with them. Don't know who they are. Funny story about From the Screen to the Stereo, Stereo to the Screen, Screen to the Stereo. They started doing those when they were lesser known and touring with bigger bands, and they wanted to play songs that everybody could sing along to. It was kind of like instant You're On Our Side music. Right. And they were so great and so good at it that they started bundling them and releasing them as EPs. And yeah, they are really fun.
Very cool. If you want to have your parting gift on our show, send it to us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. My parting gift is a new stand-up special that I watched last night with my wife. And both of us were just doubled over in laughter, loved it. Nate Bargatze, the Tennessee Kid, is on Netflix. He was one of the comedians in the show called The Stand-Ups on Netflix, which I hadn't watched his episode of, so I wasn't really even aware of him. But he does updates to some of the material he did in that special. So literally, I paused his special halfway through, went and watched the half hour of the stand-ups episode, and then came back. And I'm so glad I did, because he updates some of the stories that he tells. The thing that's great about Nate Bargatze is he's hilarious, and literally zero offensive language, zero, not a single cuss word, not a single inappropriate setup or talking about taboo subject. He just makes comedy out of stuff we all know and you can talk about and a kid could listen to, but it's hilarious. It's smart. His delivery is super dry and matter of fact. I'm now a giant fan of this guy, Nate Bargatze, the Tennessee Kid on Netflix.
Go see him live if you can. He's phenomenal and just the nicest guy.
Just seems like the nicest guy. Just the best. I mean, I just love the fact that he didn't have to say a single bad word and he could make everybody in that room just cry with laughter. It was great.
Yeah, he's one of the best. He's great.
All right, that's going to do it for this episode of DLC. Thanks again to Andrea Renee and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Thanks to our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for making those awesome bumpers. Thank you to all of you who listen to our show. We certainly appreciate you downloading it, telling your friends about it, giving us good reviews if you have the time. We'll be back next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.